I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Jury selection is underway in the Casey Anthony murder trial. Anthony is charged with first-degree murder in the 2008 death of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee. Jurors will come from Pinellas County and will be sequestered in Orlando for the duration of the trial, which is expected to be among the most expensive in state history. 90.7's Judith Smeltzer discusses the economics of a high-profile trial like the Anthony case. Plus, state lawmakers worked into the wee hours last weekend to conclude this year's legislative session. Who are the winners and losers? We'll hear from 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. The Casey Anthony trial is about to get underway in Orlando, bringing hundreds of people and lots of media attention with it. 90.7's Judith Smeltzer spoke with Charles Rose about the economic aspects of the trial. Rose directs the Center for Excellence in Advocacy at the Stetson University College of Law. He spoke from member station WUSF in Tampa.
Well, first of all, when was the last time Orlando has had such a high-profile murder trial, or has there ever been one?
I don't think there's ever been one in Orlando. The closest that you could come back to would be the trial in Volusia County, where you had the young lady that the movie Monster was based upon. But even that pales in comparison, particularly in media coverage.
Well, the Casey Anthony trial is expected to be one of the most expensive trials, not just in Orange County and Orlando, but in Florida's history. Do you think it could end up being the most expensive trial in the state's history?
Well, I think at this point it would be almost impossible to treat this trial like any other, because almost absolutely nothing that's happened in it has been predictable. So I would not be at all surprised if it becomes the most expensive trial in Florida's history.
Well, Orange County's 9th Judicial Court here did a breakdown of the costs for the Orlando Sentinel recently, and they estimated that the Anthony trial itself, just the trial alone, could cost the Orange County court system more than $360,000. And I understand most of that is associated with the jury, because they're bringing in a jury from out of town to hear this case. Does that figure seem about right to you? What does the court have to pay for, other than, of course, hotel rooms?
Well, if you think about it for a moment, when you bring in a jury, you have to pay for hotel rooms, you have to pay for food, you have to pay for transportation, you have to pay for security. It's just like having a traveling professional athletic team or any other group that you take from one place to another that you're now responsible for. And they're going to be responsible for them pretty much 24/7 until the trial is over with.
Well, how unusual is it to actually bring in an out-of-town jury like this, as opposed to moving a high-profile trial to another venue altogether?
Well, it is relatively unusual. The last really high-profile case we had in Florida was the Jessica Lunsford murders, where we tried a Vandercooey over in Tampa. And in that particular time, we made the decision to take him down to Miami. And he sort of goes off the radar at that point, and it just becomes one more case in the Miami criminal system. He had some news coverage, but it wasn't that big a deal, and it just sort of petered away. You're going to get exactly the opposite effect here. You're going to bring this jury into what is already fairly described as a maelstrom of media activity, and it's not going to get any better. It's a decision that's well within the purview of the court. Other folks might have done it differently.
Why do you think the court would have done that, would have made that decision instead of moving the venue altogether? I mean, what are the advantages? Are there cost advantages? Are there any advantages in your view?
Well, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. If you don't bring the jury to you, then you have to bring yourself, the witnesses, the defendant, the defendant's witnesses. You have to bring everybody to the other location. And you got to remember, she's an indigent defendant now. So the state would wind up paying for all of those witnesses that are probably local to Orange County to go somewhere else. And you begin to balance it, and you begin to look at issues of control and the ability to produce witnesses who have been subpoenaed. And there's an argument that's relatively strong that it just makes more sense to keep it in Orange County for those reasons.
So from a cost perspective, do you think it would equal out either way?
I would say it's probably 6-1 or half a dozen of the other. It's going to be about the same when it's all said and done.
Now, you mentioned the fact that Casey Anthony is indigent, and she was declared indigent last year. And that $360,000 figure doesn't include expenses like the cost to defend her, to provide her with lawyers, the cost to prosecute and investigate the case itself. What extra costs are we talking about there?
You know, it would be almost impossible to capture all of them, quite frankly, because we don't set up the system to capture those costs on an individual case basis, because if we began to do that, then justice would be identified by how much it would cost and not by whether or not it's the right thing to do. And we may be at a place in the United States where we worry more about money than we used to, but we haven't yet put a price tag on justice such that you can't do what needs to be done in a criminal court. That being said, consider the salaries of the state's attorneys that have worked on it, the salaries of the defense attorneys, the monies that were spent privately by the defense before she became indigent, the costs associated with the investigation, the costs associated with scientific testing, the costs associated with providing scientific experts for the defense. And you're talking a case that's going to be worth well in excess of $1 million in cost when you're done. And that's just a guesstimate without actually sitting down and doing every calculation.
You know, you talk about the fact that you can't put a price on justice, but isn't there a balancing act to be done there? Because if the courts are spending so much money on this case, does that mean that they can't try other cases?
Well, it doesn't mean that they can't try other cases. It means that they may decide not to bring those other cases. And by decide not to bring those other cases, what I'm really talking about is prosecutorial discretion. The state's attorney's offices across the state every day decide not to bring a case or to bring a case. And they decide them for a variety of reasons, some of them having to do with money, some of them having to do with problems of proof, some of them having to do with it's just not fair to bring that sort of case. Money is never the deciding factor. Because quite frankly, what politician in their right mind wants to be the one to tell the family of a victim, well, we'd love to prosecute, but we really can't afford it? That's the way district attorneys get fired. That's the way judges get thrown off the bench, and that's the way sometimes governors get removed. So that won't happen. The money will come from somewhere if it has to. But what will happen is that there'll be cases that are close, that could go one way or the other, that won't go the way they could have gone. There might be a plea deal that was cut for a lesser sentence to avoid the cost of prosecution. There might be a case that could have been a death penalty case that won't be a death penalty case. Somebody somewhere will be counting those beans, but it won't be someone that you actually see counting those financial beans within the justice system.
Obviously, the costs are going to be high for this case, but on the other side, there are bound to be economic benefits to the area, too. I mean, looking at media alone, more than 500 journalists have applied for press credentials to cover this trial. So what kind of economic benefits do you think Orlando and Florida can expect to see from this?
Well, I think you're going to get coverage. You're going to get coverage nationally and internationally by multiple media outlets. It's an opportunity for the state of Florida to show that we're serious about providing justice to all its citizens, and we're also serious about providing justice to victims of crime. So from that perspective, we look good. Financially, you're going to have hotels that are full, restaurants that are packed. You're going to have a focus on that area that can't help but create an economic benefit. It's never something that you consider as someone who is involved in the process of trying the case, but it is a very real benefit to the city. But you've got to look at it the other way. The city's also paying an awful lot of money to provide the additional security and the additional crowd control that they're going to have to deal with.
Absolutely. I mean, the Orlando City Council just approved an ordinance addressing traffic and parking concerns and that kind of thing. Can you put any kind of a price tag on what those kinds of crowd control and traffic control things could cost versus, you know, the economic impact of the hotels and businesses being patronized?
There are so many variables that it would be almost impossible to sort it out. But I will just say this. Do you know how incredibly uncommon it is for a city government to pass an ordinance to deal with a situation that is driven specifically by a criminal trial? That's the sort of thing that just does not happen. And yet it's happening now.
you know, I want to go back to something you said earlier, which was interesting, which was that Florida would look good in the eyes of the press and the national media coverage because Florida was going to be able to prove that it's committed to providing justice. Could it work the other way? I mean, a lot of people look at this case as kind of a circus and look at the characters in it as somewhat unseemly. Do you think Florida could come out with the black eye in the national press? Is there that a possibility?
I think if the only people involved were the advocates, the litigants, it's possible. But what we have in this particular scenario, like we have in every scenario, is an officer of the court, the representative of justice, the judge. And then we have the people. We have the citizens sitting in the jury box listening to the evidence. And we have the folks who did the hard work to identify the evidence or the lack thereof. And they'll be heard. And the fact that we will spend this amount of time and this amount of effort, despite the media coverage, despite the actions of individuals who might be involved for reasons other than representing a client, perhaps for their own personal aggrandizement or something else, despite all of that, the lady will get her day in court. The child will be heard through the testimony of the scientific expert witnesses, and justice will be done. Our society's commitment to spend that sort of money, to go through this sort of three-ring circus to take care of these sorts of issues, is the thing that literally separates us from almost any other place on the earth. And I can't help but think that at the end of the day, it's going to make us look good and not bad.
That was Charles Rose, the director of Stetson University's College of Law Center for Excellence in Advocacy, speaking from member station WUSF in Tampa with 90.7's Judith Smeltzer. Coming up on Intersection, it's the 2011 Legislative Session Review. It's time for our monthly politics segment here on Intersection, and I'm joined by 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor. He's a Democrat, former State House representative. Welcome, Dick.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Great to have you with us. And, of course, former Republican Congressman Lou Frey. Welcome to you.
Yeah, it is nice to be here.
So this,
one of the few places you can relax.
Yes, absolutely. Just like lawmakers are doing now that the legislative session is wrapped up. They were there until 3 a.m. Saturday last week, concluding this year's session with a level of political gamesmanship so cantankerous that Senate President Mike Haridopoulos was reportedly near tears. You had the Senate bickering with the House, Republicans arguing with Republicans. Lawmakers even at the end skipped the traditional ceremonial hanky drop that signals sine die to conclude the session. So
they probably needed them for their self to take care of the tears.
Right, that's the Kleenex. Yeah,
those hankies were already designated. Well, what do you make of it, Lou Frey? What happened? Why was there a meltdown, do you think, between the House and Senate and going on until 3 a.m. in the morning on Saturday?
I guess I'd reverse the question. When really hasn't there been meltdowns between the House and Senate at an end of a session? I mean, this is like it's not nothing. I mean, this has happened before. So
the Republican Party needs a Rodney King moment. You know, can't you guys just get along?
Well, but, you know, under past governors and past legislatures, we've seen the session coming to a conclusion successfully on the Friday, 5 o'clock, that like a smooth train coasting into the station.
Yeah, but it might have gone a long time. And we never have had, at least in recent times, a thing where one party was so dominant where the governor couldn't veto a bill and be sure the veto wouldn't be overturned. So you really had incredible power in the hands of the Speaker of the House, Dean Cannon, and the President of the Senate. And they used that power. You know, just backing off a little bit and not getting into what you called a meltdown or so forth, whether you like it or not, this was a fairly aggressive, fairly efficient political machine that they had up there. They rolled a lot of things out that surprised me they got to that.
What surprised you?
Oh, just a lot of some of the legislation that I thought that the governor would get more out of it. I thought in the taxes that he got a $330 million tax break. He wanted $3.7 billion in it. He didn't seem to function really in. They sort of throw a bone over here to keep him quiet, but they went charging on. Dick, when you were there, did of course the Democrats had power then too. I mean, it was sort of a reverse situation.
Yeah, it was. It was, but I think it functioned a lot better even under the Democrat leadership.
Because you were there.
Yeah, well, hopefully. But you saw a lot of more. Our Republican leaders, minority leaders at the time, Kurt Kaiser, Ron Richmond, people like that, were deferred to a great deal and were involved in the process. And even when you made the right decision on the or the wrong decision on the final bills. But observe one thing here, too. You've got the Republican control of both houses, but frankly, Herodopoulos was probably upset because I think he got slammed by the House. But here's what they were doing. It was really unfortunate. They should have never been in session, and I think Lou will agree this, at 3 o'clock in the morning. Bad piece of legislation happened. Bad amendments get put on with no explanation whatsoever.
Nothing good happens
never
after 9.
Good happens after 9 o'clock. They should have come back, number one. What you're going to find out, if there are amendments were put on those bills, which they haven't discovered yet, that are going to be damaging, what you're going to find out, too, is some amendments were added to a bill, even though the bill was killed in committee, you know, which could have been challenged on a rule of challenge, but no one knew it was in there. The last thing is they had 44 conference committee reports. For your listener, that means the House and Senate disagree on substantive legislation or the budget, and it goes to a conference committee. When the conference committee issues a report, you cannot amend it. It's take it or leave
it. Up
or
down, 44, one
vote right there. 44 of those conference committee reports, and the powers that be, the few people involved in the circle who knew what was going on, kept adding stuff to these bills. You bring them back to the House and Senate floor, and the members aren't told that certain amendments put in. So it was a train. It was going to be derailed one way or the other. But, I mean, they got out of there. But when the dust settles, or the heifer dust settles, I think we're going to find out a lot of things passed that were never explained to the colleagues on the House floor.
And there are, of course, reports that senators were revolting as you got towards the end because they were putting bills in front of them. They didn't have a chance for an open debate on that.
Well, Senator Lynn, Senator Storms, Senator Jack Latvala, and others were raising points of order on it. But they were just pushed real through. It'd be a very interesting it was a final point, look-see from House and Senate members to see if they revolt against the leadership because of the way they were treated, miniaturized, in my opinion, this session.
And they'll have a chance on some vetoes probably early to see if they'll hang together to override the governor or some of them. You know what this may benefit, actually, thinking about it, Dick, the governor more than anybody else.
Interesting.
But yeah, because when they're looking down the line and everything, they had this person who was running around doing stuff, but he turned out to be probably a little bit maybe easier to work with than the leadership of their own party.
Lou makes a very good point, too. It's going to be very interesting politically now. If he's politically astute, I suggest he's not, but it would be see if the governor chooses two or three things at the request of his aides and say, veto two or three things, you need to make your mark. And if he does that without consulting the leadership of both sides, then I suggest that he's playing with fire at that point in time.
What do you make of the point that the Governor Rick Scott, decided not to hang around till the end of the session? Usually the governor comes out, they have a big shaking of hands and patting on the back, and Governor Scott went to bed at 1 a.m. reportedly.
It's an intelligent mood. What was he going to do?
Well, I don't think he's had much.
Should he have been there?
Yes. And he should not have had, out of respect. And he should not. He was not that obviously involved in the legislative session. I think he appeared one time on behalf of a deregulation bill or something of that nature. And he did take credit for the pill bill, even though he tried to rescind the bill. But he wasn't very obviously involved in the session. And it'd be interesting to see now that the session's over and people maybe begin to talk, to see what was the relationship between the House and Senate leaders, not just the Speaker and the Senate President, but interesting to see what kind of relationship they developed with him.
And it's also that one other thing I think we got to watch, and that is what is Scott going to do in the near term? Is he going to try and get national attention so he can be considered as, for instance, on the VP thing?
I hope.
Well, I know you do. But I think you got to look at what he's going to do and where he's going to play. And if he just sort of walks away from it again as it goes along, you can bet that he's looking to 2012 and maybe beyond if he can make a name for himself. Because I'm not so sure what he does is laying the predicate for a two-term governor.
Now, talk to me a little bit about the relationship between Dean Cannon, who is from Winter Park, Orlando, and Mike Herodopoulos out on the Space Coast. Those folks have been known as kind of gentlemen that work together a lot. And Mike Herodopoulos trying to run for the U.S. Senate. Do you think this helps, hurts his candidacy? And what about that relationship between those two politicians, Dick Batchelor?
Well, they're both very obviously very conservative, both very powerful. But I think if you looked at it, and I'm trying to be dispassionate about this observation, Dean Cannon exerted himself much more forcefully. I don't agree with it, but he exerted himself much more forcefully. In fact, the original bill that he had, which would have dismantled the Supreme Court, of course, it was a compromise when all said and done. I mean, Herod Dopplis did not want to move that bill. Keep in mind, he is running for the United States Senate, and that's the utmost in his mind. And how many constituency groups can he offend, whether it's the trial lawyers or the doctors or whomever, before he's in very hot water? You've got to raise money. Now he's got another candidate, former U.S. Senator Lemieux, has announced. So now it's everything's about the U.S. Senate race. And I think, frankly, he was out-trumped big time, no pun intended, but out-trumped by Dan Cannon and a lot of the issues.
Lou Fry?
Well, one of the things we talked about early on going in is the fact that each of these individuals, including Scott Cannon and Herod Dopplis, had their own agenda. And that agenda at some point was going to run into each other and cause a train wreck. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what happened. I thought Dean saw a chance to really make some points and move some things and that. And he did, and sort of left Mike standing behind in part of it. But you know, one of the things you always want to remember in it is the guy who voted against you today may vote for you tomorrow. So how are those two going to handle it? I don't think there's going to be a lot of public finger-pointing and so forth. If they do, both of them are going to get hurt.
You're listening to the monthly Intersection Politics segment on Intersection. We're doing a 2011 legislative session wrap-up with commentators Democrat Dick Batchelor and Republican Lou Fry. I'm Mark Simpson. Well, lawmakers did approve a $70 billion state budget, and the budget delivers about $308 million in tax cuts that Governor Rick
Scott—
That's
the corporate tax, right?
Yeah,
right.
And that is, of course, a fraction of what the governor was looking for. He wanted a $1 billion in corporate and property tax cuts. So, I mean, do you call it a successful session for Governor Scott?
I think that was successful because in his mind, he's trying to change the pattern of what's going on, and he's trying to send a signal out that Florida really wants business. I don't think it's an effective way of doing it, but if that grows down the line and he can raise it, the number, yeah. He keeps talking about jobs, the 770,000 jobs in that, and I think, you know, we're 1 year's starting to go by, and we're starting to look to see where the jobs are, But I think that was pretty good. And he kept, you know, one of the things you got to give him credit for, he really kept out of any real mess. I mean, he didn't end up in some of the, he didn't end up particularly in the abortion issue and you know, and that he.
What about immigration, do you think, Lou Fry?
Well,
he tried to push through an immigration bill similar to Arizona, but it wasn't going to go through,
and he backed off. Again, I think pretty good instincts knowing that wasn't going to go anywhere. And why bleed to death? Some of our colleagues in Washington ought to learn that.
Well, if nothing else, he's almost mastered rising above principle. Keep in mind, again, he was going to kill the whole the pill bill and on the pain clinics, and then he goes and now takes credit for actually passing the legislation with the assistance of Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. But also in immigration, keep in mind, too, these constituent groups were very outspoken. The group most opposed to the immigration bill was the business community. The Chamber of Commerce was very much opposed to it. So now you've got a very conservative Chamber of Commerce opposing immigration reform. So it's tough. But he did get immigration reform. He got the pill bill. Now, he did get some tax cuts. But the fact is, I would argue that all he did was take $300 million out of a $4 billion shortfall budget anyway, and that tax break is just going to hurt more people than it's going to help. If you look at the national studies, when corporations move to states, about number five on the issue on the checklist is corporate income taxes. Florida has, we're in the lowest quartile in the country. We have very low corporate income tax. Herod Dopplis even said at the beginning of the section, no one's come up to him and said, my corporate income tax is too high. In fact, Scott Maxwell did a column that said only less than 5% of corporations pay corporate income tax in the state of Florida. So it's not a big issue, but it was symbolic to him.
It was. It was a good one to pick.
It was symbolic for him.
How about the environment? That's the one that I kept looking at.
You're talking about community affairs,
the
department being
the
dismantled.
Everglades and just
environment. What environment?
Yeah.
The Growth Management Act was repealed. That was a 1985 measure. Florida was thought of to be progressive.
When I wanted to be governor, I thought that they had to coexist. I thought a good environment was good for the state in terms of business and that you'd coexist. There'd have to be compromises along the line, and you know, you can argue maybe we had too many people looking the environment or not enough, but now it's sort of like it's a one-way street, and you know, I live here with my own feelings about it, but I like the waters to be clean, and I like the Everglades to to eventually end up working the way they're supposed to. And you look at that, and I think the environment took as big a hit as any other area.
Governor Scott arguing that these changes, eliminating the Department of Community Affairs, which is the state's planning and community development agency, repealing the Growth Management Act from 1985, will make a better environment for generating growth and jobs. What do you think about it, Dick Batchelor?
Specious argument. The fact is the environment. You took the 1985 Growth Management Law, which requires comprehensive plan, amendments to
it. Comprehensive planning, yep.
Development, regional impact, you know, protection, those kind of things. And not only did they eviscerate the law, but they changed it in a very late night amendment again. An amendment was never heard, and that is traditional. If somebody's going to build a waste plant in your backyard or a nuclear power plant, you as a private citizen have the right to go protest that. And the company that's applying for the permit must prove that they're not going to do any damage, environmental damage. When the late of night they offered an amendment, which passed now, if you, the neighbor who's being impacted,
you must bear
the burden of proof that it will, in fact, impact your life. That is a radical change from everything. So the whole growth management law, DRIs, and now a developer can come in and forget concurrency. Developer will come in and say, I'm going to build 5,000 new homes.
I don't care about the roads.
I don't care about the schools. I don't care about infrastructure.
Those costs go to local governments.
Those costs go to local government. And by the way, local government's going to get hit, too, because they've now put on the ballot, if it passes, a corporate tax for ad valorem purposes. And that way, a corporation would all have almost like the Save Our Homes protection. Your taxes could go up more than 5% a year, and that's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So when the public figure out what the legislature did, I think they're going to, again, conclude it was pretty different.
Lou Fry, can you call that kind of change to the way Florida's going to grow, going back to the old model of just a rampant sprawl coming back, or is this creative destruction going to promote some actual jobs and more development?
I think it'll create some jobs, and I think the issue is not if the jobs will be created, but can you create jobs that coexist with the environment? To me, the answer, yeah, you should. I think they can both do it. You may not get quite as many jobs, but in the long run, if this state doesn't have the environment to attract people, and that we're in deep, deep trouble business-wise.
You mentioned lawmakers approved this measure addressing pill mills, which dispense illicit prescription pain drugs. This measure that was passed makes the way for a statewide drug database to take effect later this summer. Initially, it was opposed by Governor Scott. He later reversed his position, now supporting that database. Do you think the measure is going to successfully address the pill mill problem?
Well, we all hope so. There are literally thousands of deaths every year in Florida. People dying from prescribed drugs. Oxycontin and painkillers are a big one on that, and they have to be regulated. And these pill mills are just writing prescriptions. They're almost printing them and handing them out. In fact, there's a term called the pillbillies, and that's because you can get out of state, you can come to Florida, and you can go from one pain management clinic to another. Then you take the Oxycontin, you take it back to Kentucky, and you sell it in the mountainside, and you get people hooked on it. It's a very disastrous thing that's happening. So this has got to help. And if it saves one life, it's been worth it. But we're seeing our friends that we know, and Lou knows, their kids have actually died for prescribed overdoses.
Do you think politically Pam Bondi was helping to drive this measure through the legislature? Is this something she's going to be able to stand on?
When she runs for governor?
For another office.
Yes. When she runs for governor?
3 years,
Lou Fry, you say it.
Well, I mean, there's three. You know, the three cabinet officers are all looking at running for governor. And the answer is yeah, of course. This is a good one. Everybody understands it. It's not a Republican or Democratic bill. This is one of the kind you want. Do this one, let everybody know about it, and just the others just put on the side.
Well, we've been talking with 90.7's political commentators, Democrat Dick Batchelor, former State House representative, now with the Dick Batchelor Management Group, and former Republican Congressman Lou Fry, now with Lounge Drostic Doster Cantor and Reed. Good speaking with you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.